My perspective here comes out of my training as somebody who spent a lot of time studying the courts, studying constitutional law. But I always have to make sure it's clear that I am not a lawyer. I cannot give you legal advice. None of this is intended to be legal advice, right? That'd be on the email if I were sending it. Okay, so let me also then give you a brief overview of what I want to cover. When I realized I only had an hour and that you all would probably want to talk about this too, I got a little scared. So I'm going to try to do this as quickly as I can to leave plenty of time for more of a conversation. Because I know that's one of the main points of this enrichment series. But I want to start by talking about the Second Amendment and provide a little bit of what we would call legislative history. How did we get what we have? I want to move on to briefly kind of cover the debate over collective versus individual rights, because that's really been at the core of the debate on the meaning of the Second Amendment. Does it protect a collective right for defense, or does it provide an individual right to keep and bear arms? I'll go through three early tests at the Supreme Court, as well as three recent cases, and give you a preview of a case that will actually come to the court sometime next year. I'll try to offer some conclusions, and then, of course, move on to questions and discussion. Okay, so here's the Second Amendment as we have come to know it. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Of course, the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Now, to understand this, or really any of the other amendments, it's important to kind of understand the context within which the Constitution was written. And I always like to start with that, with the concept of the Constitution as a charter of negative rights. And what we mean by that is that the Constitution does not give rights directly to the people. It does not say, for example, you have freedom of speech, or the people have freedom of speech. It says the right of freedom of, or the, essentially the right of free speech shall not be abridged. And we can parenthetically add to any of these amendments, shall not be abridged by government. Right? That's what the framers were intending. They weren't intending to confer positive rights to people, because of course, if the government could say you have a right to something, the government could then also take away that right. So the framework, the lens through which the framers were engaging with the Constitution as they were drafting it, was really through this lens of people have certain fundamental rights that exists within them simply by virtue of having been born. And that if we allow government to be responsible for stating what those rights are in the affirmative, that also means government has extraordinary power to come back and remove them. So the framers were trying to make clear by grounding the Constitution generally, but particularly the Bill of Rights, in this natural rights tradition, that government doesn't really have a role to play in whether or not we have the rights that are expressed in the Bill of Rights. These rights exist for us simply because we were born. There's some other important context that I want to make sure we have, and that is the legislative history. And so the Second Amendment is ultimately part of the Bill of Rights. We know it today as the first 10 amendments to the Constitution. But it was not originally proposed as a separate set of amendments, the Bill of Rights. In fact, there was great debate in the first Congress, so 1789 and 1790, that first Congress when the folks who had framed the government are now actually governing. And the debate initially begins over whether to, in essence, just strike out the body of the articles, the pieces of the articles that they no longer thought were sufficient, and add language in, kind of like we might do today if we're part of a representative group. We might say, let's strike that language and just change it to something else. And they had great debate over whether they should do that so that the document itself simply remained a simple document, or whether they should add true amendments, essentially an appendix to the document listing the changes that they wanted to make. And this debate, by the way, goes on for quite some time. They ultimately settle on, we'll add it as a separate document because we want people to see the evolution of our thinking. If we simply make changes and print, or at the time they would have copied, lots of new versions, it will be forgotten what the original said over time. And we want there to be essentially a running record of how this document has been changed. So they have that debate to kind of begin the discussion on a Bill of Rights. They debate whether do we really even need to make these amendments. And of course, you have folks like James Madison and others saying, our states ratified the Constitution with the understanding that a Bill of Rights would be added. We need to do this. So Madison proposes in early June a slate of amendments. The original proposal for the Second Amendment is on the screen. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, a well-armed and well-regulated militia being the best security of a free country. But no person religiously scrupulous of bearing arms shall be compelled to render service in person. And so one of the first things that I think it's important to point out is that the original proposal for the Second Amendment included this essentially conscientious objector clause. If we think about why that might be, one of the arguments has been made that this clearly demonstrates that the framers were thinking of the right to keep and bear arms in the context of militia service exclusively. As we'll see later, the Supreme Court ultimately concludes that's not the only way that that could be interpreted. But there was real concern because the states actually at the time required essentially able-bodied men to supply their own arms and their own ammunition in order to be called to participate if a militia needed to be formed. And so the concern that Madison is trying to address in his original draft is essentially if we're going to require militia service of all able-bodied men, which subsequently requires them to possess arms in case they're called out to participate, what should we do if somebody has a sincere religious objection to participating? And they have a lengthy debate about the Quakers and about the concern that there is a body of citizens that would be really potentially uncomfortable with being forced to participate in the military and potentially being forced to have weapons that they have to possess, kind of contravening their religious views. So I thought you all might find that interesting because certainly that is relevant to the conversations you might have about kind of the role of faith and thinking about firearms. This provision becomes essentially the sole focus of the debate in the House of Representatives on the Second Amendment. So the idea that we could look for evidence of kind of framers' intent, what did they really mean by arms, what did they mean by keep and bear, you can't see any of that in that debate because the framers get really bogged down in debating this religious exemption piece. So you have people like Elbridge Gerry, or Jerry, father of gerrymandering. Gerry is concerned about this religious exemption provision because he said somebody, presumably the government, will have to decide what is a religiously scrupulous objection. How can we know what makes somebody sincerely objecting? And so there'll have to be some sort of test. There'll have to be some sort of measure, and it will have to be the government that would have to grant that exemption. And if the government can grant the exemption, the government could presumably grant exemptions to everybody in a particular jurisdiction and therefore render a militia absolutely impotent to handle any kind of conflict, right? So Gerry is making the argument, and he's very passionate about this, that you can't include this exemption because somebody will have to verify it. And once you give government that authority, that authority could be taken to an extreme. James Jackson from Georgia argues that exempting people from military service based on religious principle would be unjust, as he says, because, quote, one part would have to defend the other in the case of an invasion. And so they have this sort of silly discussion back and forth about, like, well, what if the community was majority Quaker and then the non-Quakers would have total responsibility for protecting all these Quakers, and that would be really unfair to all of these non-Quakers who would have the burden of collective defense. They debate this back and forth for quite a while. Ultimately, they strike this language by a vote of 29 to 24 in the House of Representatives. So that's how close they came to leaving this religious exemption in. It also tells you something about the small number of people who were involved in making the decision about what these amendments would look like. Now, in the Senate Journal is nowhere near as comprehensive as the House records are. So the Senate Journal simply records that on September 9, 1789, there was an attempt in the Senate to add a clause to say that there would be the right of the people to keep and bear arms for the common defense. But the Senate Journal records that that was failed. There's no record of what the vote was. So you do see that there is a bit of discussion, at least in the Senate, about what is the purpose of bearing arms. But because we don't have clear records as to what that debate looked like, it's hard to know how robust it was or really what the major arguments were. Okay, so at the kind of heart of the question surrounding the Second Amendment is this issue of whether the Second Amendment provides a collective right or whether it provides for an individual right. The collectivist view is simply that the right to keep and bear arms is only in the interest of collective self-defense. Of course, historically or at the time, that would have been from a tyrannical federal government or some kind of foreign invader. The individual view is that the right to keep and bear arms is guaranteed to individuals, some would say for the purpose of self-defense, others would say for whatever purpose the individual wants to use them. The consensus for a good part of maybe the last 30 or 40 years, well, I take it back, go back before that, for much of the 20th century at least, was that the right to keep and bear arms is guaranteed to individuals, but there are limited purposes for that. And that right can be, that right, states have the right to impose limits on the right to keep and bear arms. But this is really at the heart of the debate. If we believe that the Second Amendment is only guaranteeing a collective right, then the notion that people can have weapons for whatever purpose they want falls away. On the other hand, if we believe in an unfettered individual right, then people can have really any weapon of any type for any purpose, and no one should be able to say anything about it. And then this sort of third approach suggests maybe a middle ground. Well, maybe you have an individual right, but there should be some limits. All right, well, let's see what the court said about this. I want to talk about three cases. And I should preface this by saying that when Hal asked me if I would give a presentation about the Supreme Court and jurisprudence, and a few years ago I was here and I talked about the First Amendment's religion guarantees, and I had like 500 cases I could have covered for you, and I like boiled it down to about six or seven. But even with that, I was like, well, and there's this other thing, right? I said to Hal, like, there are only a handful of cases at the court that the court has ever decided on this issue. This is simply not an area where the Supreme Court has been particularly active. He said, okay, we'll say that. I was like, okay. In the other 59 minutes, I'm not sure what we're going to talk about, so I want to preface this by saying that, you know, we talk about early tests. There really aren't any super early tests. The first significant cases come up in the 1870s. This should not be a particular surprise if we remember our US history, because what's happening in the 1870s, we're deep into the Reconstruction era. We see the federal government taking a very active role in trying to promote Reconstruction and trying to promote particular types of laws that impose punishments, particularly on Southerners who do things that it doesn't like. So the first case I'll talk about is U.S. v. Cruikshank. In this case, Cruikshank and another man are indicted and tried under the Civil Rights Act of 1870 for lynching two African Americans. Now, the Civil Rights Act of 1870, and you would say, well, why is this a federal case? Partly it's because it's the Reconstruction era, and so you have Reconstruction government governments in the South, but partly it's because the Civil Rights Act of 1870 made it a crime to deprive anybody of any right guaranteed by the federal government. Okay, so think about all the Bill of Rights. So the logic behind the law was, we know that tensions in the South are pretty high. We know there are all these newly freed slaves. We know that they may be at risk for violence. So we want to criminalize or do what we can to deter criminal activity or violence against former slaves. So they make it a crime to deprive any citizen of the federal government. So under the 14th Amendment, former slaves are citizens, male former slaves are citizens of the federal government. And so included in the indictment, among the list of laws that these two men, or list of protections these two men were alleged to have violated, was the Second Amendment right to, quote, bear arms for a lawful purpose. And the court finds that, first of all, that's not what the Second Amendment says, right? The Second Amendment actually doesn't say you have the right to keep and bear arms for a lawful purpose, so you can't have an indictment saying that that right has been violated, because that's not a right that exists. So first thing they say. But the second thing they say is that this is not an amendment that is intended to allow lawsuits to be brought against individuals, because the Second Amendment is intended to protect deprivations of rights by the national government. So in other words, they're striking down the Civil Rights Act of 1870, because what they're saying is only the federal government can deprive someone of a Second Amendment right, or of any right contained in the Bill of Rights. You can't individuals can't deprive somebody of rights that the government is prohibited from depriving someone of. And the court also goes back to this natural rights argument and says, quote, this is not a right, meaning the right to bear arms, this is not a right granted by the Constitution, neither is it in any manner dependent upon that instrument for its existence. In other words, it's sort of another nail in the coffin of the idea that individuals could somehow be responsible for depriving other individuals of constitutional rights. And they're arguing here that this is a natural right. The right to keep and bear arms comes out of British common law. It comes from by virtue of being born. So the idea that the Constitution has any role in giving people that right is sort of nonsense. That's the court, 1876. There's a similar case that comes up about 10 years later. So in Presser v. Illinois, there is a law in Illinois that bars groups of men from possessing arms and engaging in military drills unless they're part of the official state militia. So I'm like visualizing this. Like, apparently people would get together, bring their armaments and drill for fun and sport without being part of any kind of officially called militia. I don't know, it's Illinois in 1886. I don't know what else you do there. Maybe you do this. And so Illinois passes a law that says, this is illegal. Okay? Like, you cannot get together with your friends and engage in military-style drills with your guns unless you're part of an official militia. And so the the appellants, the people who are upset about this, ask the court to overturn that state law as a violation of the Second Amendment's right that would allow them to keep and bear arms. And the court declines to overturn it. The court says the Second Amendment, this is just like Cruikshank, does not apply to the states. The Second Amendment is only a prohibition on the federal government. And to understand how that logic worked, you have to know a little bit about this notion of incorporation, or the idea that at some point the national constitution, the federal constitution, is going to apply to the states. So until the 14th Amendment is ratified in 1868, nobody makes any kind of argument to suggest that, there are arguments made to suggest that the Constitution applies to the states, but the court doesn't hear them, right? The court says the Constitution applies only to the federal government, so if there are constitutional rights guaranteed to people, those rights only apply to people in the context of federal behavior. The 14th Amendment, though, included its own due process clause. And that due process clause was identical to the due process clause that already existed in the Fifth Amendment. And so lawyers and judges started to say, well, what would the purpose of having two due process clauses be? And the consensus emerged over time that the purpose of the due process clause in the 14th Amendment was to apply the due process guarantees from the Fifth Amendment and of the federal constitution to the states. That's the consensus that emerges over time. But in 1886, there is no consensus that the constitution applies at the state level. The Bill of Rights is not binding on the states. The process of incorporation doesn't actually begin for another decade, and it doesn't really occur in earnest until the era, or the period between about 1920 and 1970. So it's really the 1960s where we start to see the constitutional guarantees in the Bill of Rights, particularly the Fourth, the Fifth, the Sixth, the Eighth Amendment, being applied at the state level. But in 1886, there's no notion that the states have to conform to the federal constitution. And so the Supreme Court in this case says states can do whatever they want. States can regulate guns. The federal government can't do that, but the states can do it. In Robertson v. Baldwin, the court takes up a somewhat related question. In this case, the question is whether laws that prohibited concealed weapons were unconstitutional. This is another kind of, it's a related question, right, to can states regulate how people engage with firearms. And in this case, the court really reinforces that the Second Amendment is not unlimited, and it's not unlimited as it applies at the state level. So a particularly, I think, interesting quote from that case: the law is perfectly well settled that the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, commonly known as the Bill of Rights, were not intended to lay down any novel principles of government, but simply to embody certain guarantees and immunities which we have inherited from our English ancestors and which have from time immemorial been subject to certain well-recognized exceptions arising from the necessities of the case. Thus, the right of the people to keep and bear arms is not infringed by laws prohibiting the carrying of concealed weapons. So in Robertson v. Baldwin, you get another extension of the Presser case. Again, it's coincidence that it's 1897, because this is not incorporating anything. You just get an extension of the court's logic in Presser, which is to say that kind of reasonable limits on keeping and bearing arms don't infringe on somebody's right to keep and bear arms. Okay, so what are some of the implications of these cases? At the turn of the 20th century, the consensus, at least kind of legally or judicially, was that the Second Amendment was a limitation on the federal government, not on the states or on individuals. And the court is clear that states can pass reasonable regulation or even ban guns or gun-related activity. States can do it in areas that states have control. They're clear that it still remains a prohibition on Congress. Okay, so let's turn to the more recent cases, and I think you'll see here a pretty stark evolution in the court's approach to this issue. The first thing I want to point out is the 70-year gap between U.S. v. Miller, which for a very long time, certainly when I was in college and graduate school and taking constitutional law, right, which was well before Heller and McDonald, U.S. v. Miller was the standard. That was the landmark case that kind of told us what we needed to know about the Second Amendment. So just notice that we don't see very much at all happening in that 70-year period. I'll come back to that in a minute because there is a reason that that changes. So U.S. v. Miller is the most important case regarding the Second Amendment in the 20th century. Two men are indicted for transporting a sawed-off shotgun across state lines, and this is a violation of federal law. So they are appealing their conviction for having been convicted of violating federal law about transporting sawed-off shotguns. They are, again, convicted. They ask the Supreme Court to overturn their conviction and to say that this federal regulation is unconstitutional. Because based on those 19th century cases, if the Second Amendment is a prohibition on Congress, then Congress should not have made any law about transporting sawed-off shotguns or any other restriction on guns. And so here you get, really, in 1939, the first real test of whether the federal government can impose restrictions on gun ownership or use or possession. And the court actually says, yes, the federal government can do this. And it's U.S. v. Miller where we get the most thorough analysis of the context within which the Second Amendment was written. So if you read one case about historically looks at guns, I'd say U.S. v. Miller should be that case. The ultimate decision they make is, quote, in the absence of any evidence tending to show that possession or use of a shotgun having a barrel of less than 18 inches in length, sawed-off shotgun, right? Because you have to have a clear definition in the law, right? So you can't just say sawed-off shotgun because that's not a thing. It's a thing, but it's not a legal thing. But shotgun having a barrel of less than 18 inches in length at this time, so in the absence of evidence showing that possession at this time has some reasonable relationship to the preservation or efficiency of a well-regulated militia, we cannot say that the Second Amendment guarantees the right to keep and bear such an instrument. Certainly it's not within judicial notice that this weapon is any part of the ordinary military equipment or that its use could contribute to the common defense. So this is a pretty clear statement by the court saying the Second Amendment protects a collective right. So now we're moving away from this notion that the federal government can't impose any limits to a notion that says actually the federal government can if the limits are separate from what might be reasonably necessary to allow a militia to exist. And I'll read you just a couple of other comments because this will kind of flesh out something I talked about before. But they really dive into kind of the legislative history and the purpose of the amendment. And so the court writes in U.S. v. Miller, the signification attributed to the term militia appears from the debates in the convention, the history and legislation of colonies and states, and the writings of approved commentators. These show plainly enough that the militia comprised all males physically capable of acting in concert for the common defense. And further, that ordinarily, when called for service, these men were expected to appear bearing arms supplied by themselves and of the kind in common use at the time. And then the court goes on to cite the requirements for male citizens or able-bodied males. And so I'll read you Virginia's because that's one of the examples that the court uses. In 1785, again, this is coming out of U.S. v. Miller, Virginia passed a statute that declared, quote, "The defense and safety of the Commonwealth depend upon having its citizens properly armed and taught the knowledge of military duty. All free male persons between the ages of 18 and 50 years, with certain exceptions, shall be enrolled or formed into companies. There shall be a private muster of every company once in 2 months. Every officer and soldier shall appear at his respective muster field on the day appointed by 11 o'clock in the forenoon." I'm going to start using forenoon, by the way, instead of morning. "By 11 o'clock in the forenoon, armed, equipped, and accoutred as follows. Every non-commissioned officer and private with a good, clean musket carrying an ounce ball and 3 feet, 8 inches long in the barrel, with a good bayonet and iron ramrod well fitted thereto. A cartridge box properly made to contain and secure 20 cartridges fitted to his musket, a good knapsack and canteen, and moreover, each non-commissioned officer and private shall have at every muster 1 pound of good powder and 4 pounds of lead, including 20 blank cartridges, and each sergeant shall have a pair of molds fit to cast balls for their respective companies to be purchased by the commanding officer out of the monies arising on delinquencies." Okay, so it's a good thing you have to have a knapsack because you have a lot of stuff to bring, right? When I got to the part about 4 pounds of lead, I was like, oh my gosh, right? This is a lot of stuff you had to be responsible for. And this does, by the way, I think help provide some context for the religious exemption piece that we talked about earlier, right? Because if the law required you to have all of these things, then what if you were religiously, sincerely opposed to engaging in this kind of drill or of engaging in any kind of combat? So it starts, this U.S. v. Miller starts to actually add context to what we previously talked about. So what we're seeing here is that at the time of the drafting of the Second Amendment, states were legally requiring the possession and carrying of arms for all able-bodied male citizens. But what U.S. v. Miller says is that those early post-colonial laws are really helping us to understand what the framers were intending. And in their view, the court that decides U.S. v. Miller, the Second Amendment, as proposed, limits the federal government from interfering in state self-defense schemes and therefore is only about a collective self-defense right. Right? That's the U.S. v. Miller position. Now that's the position, again, that I learned when I was going through these constitutional law classes. There were some other cases I should mention that come up before D.C. v. Heller. They weren't about kind of the core meaning of the Second Amendment. They were about things like, there's a case in 1980 called Lewis v. U.S., where a guy is, he's basically convicted of a felony, but hadn't been provided legal counsel. And so, but he's convicted, therefore he's prohibited from owning a firearm. He's rearrested later, he's carrying a gun. He then challenges his initial conviction for the felony and says, well, I wasn't represented by counsel, so it's invalid. The courts agreed. So then he said, well, then since I didn't actually have a felony conviction, I can have a gun, right? And the courts disagreed and said, the law clearly makes it clear that if you believe you've been wrongfully convicted, you should address that before you go and get a gun. But again, that's sort of a minor case where the gun is sort of irrelevant. It's more a question about the timing of appealing a wrongful conviction. So the next major landmark case comes 70 years later. It's only been 11 years, but in this particular case, DC prohibited registration of handguns and provided that any guns that were possessed in a person's home had to be rendered inoperable via trigger locks and gun safes. Mr. Heller seeks to register. He's a special police officer in the district. He seeks to register his personal firearm, and the district tells him no. And so he ultimately appeals that, saying, this violates my right under the Second Amendment. The case ends up going to the D.C. Circuit Court. The D.C. Circuit Court agrees with Mr. Heller and says, this notion of a total prohibition on guns and requiring them to be inoperable if they are possessed is a violation of the Second Amendment. The district appeals that to the court, and so the court takes up the question, and the court agrees with the D.C. Circuit. It is unconstitutional to prohibit the registration of a handgun, and moreover, it's unconstitutional to make it impossible for somebody to engage in self-defense. Now, the logic of Heller is the absolute opposite of the logic in Miller. So in Heller, and the opinions written by Antonin Scalia, he says the concept of the right of the people can only mean the right of any or all individuals to keep and bear arms, so it's an individual right, because the militia that's referred to in the Second Amendment is a subset of the people, he says. So it can't simply be that the right is conferred to the militia, because the militia didn't encompass all people in a community. As we read, it was able-bodied men between certain ages. And since the militia is a subset of the people, all people have to have this individual right in order that a militia could be formed. He goes on to say, to sort of tackle some of the other questions that had come up as part of the case, he goes on to say, well, some people have said, well, handguns could not possibly have been anticipated by the framers. That wasn't what they were talking about. They, you know, were talking about long guns or muskets. And he says, I'll just read to you, some have made the argument bordering on the frivolous that only those arms in existence in the 18th century are protected by the Second Amendment. We do not interpret constitutional rights that way. Just as the First Amendment protects modern forms of communications and the Fourth Amendment applies to modern forms of search, and the Second Amendment extends to all instruments that constitute bearable arms, even those that were not in existence at the time of the founding. But that said, Scalia goes on to say, nothing in our opinion should be taken to cast doubt on longstanding prohibitions on the possession of firearms by felons and the mentally ill, or laws forbidding the carrying of firearms in sensitive places, such as schools and government buildings, or laws imposing conditions and qualifications on the commercial sale of arms. We also recognize another important limitation on the right to keep and carry arms. Miller said, as we've explained, that the sorts of weapons protected were those in common use at the time. We think that limitation is fairly supported by the historical tradition of prohibiting the carrying of dangerous and unusual weapons. So there's an effort to kind of say this is an unfettered individual right, except it's not totally unfettered, right? And the thinking in legal circles is that Scalia had to add that kind of disclaimer paragraph because he couldn't get five votes without it. Okay? Because this is so antithetical. He spends probably 30 pages of the opinion going through his historical analysis, basically arguing that this is an individual right. And so then you get to this sort of bizarre paragraph that seems to be a retreat from everything that he's just said. And the thinking is he couldn't get that fifth vote for the majority if he hadn't added that. The summary paragraph in Heller, I think, is informative. I'll come back to this in just a couple of slides in the conclusion. This is the concluding, it's a single paragraph, but for readability, I split it into two. This is the concluding paragraph. Scalia writes, "We are aware of the problem of handgun violence in this country, and we take seriously the concerns raised by the many amici who believe that the prohibition of handgun ownership is a solution. The Constitution leaves the District of Columbia a variety of tools for combating that problem, including some measures regulating handguns. But the enshrinement of constitutional rights necessarily takes certain policy choices off the table. These include the absolute prohibition of handguns held and used for self-defense in the home. Undoubtedly, some think that the Second Amendment is outmoded in a society where our standing army is the pride of our nation, where well-trained police forces provide personal security, and where gun violence is a serious problem. That is perhaps debatable, but what is not debatable is that it is not the role of this court to pronounce the Second Amendment extinct." So I'll talk about that concluding paragraph in a minute, because I think that's actually, it's been fairly ignored, and I think it's a really important one. But before I do that, I want to quickly mention McDonald v. City of Chicago. So McDonald v. City of Chicago was actually filed on the same day that the court hands down its Heller decision. That's not a coincidence. The sort of same people that had been supporting Heller and the same folks who had been filing briefs in support of an individual right to bear arms were also advising in the McDonald case, and they anticipated, based on the oral argument, that the court was likely to be sympathetic to an individual right. And so the same morning that they announce Heller, they submit McDonald. And the question that's presented is that, given that an individual right to bear arms exists, is the Second Amendment applicable to the states? Because remember that DC is not a state. DC is still governed by the federal government, which means that the one thing that Heller could not do is incorporate the protections of the Second Amendment to the states. So McDonald is necessary if that's your goal, if requiring the states to abide by the Second Amendment is your goal. McDonald is the necessary second step that has to happen. You need the court to do what it did in Heller, but then that can't be applied at the state level. So in McDonald, the court says, yes, the individual right exists, and therefore the 14th Amendment incorporates the Second Amendment to the states in the same way that the 4th, the 5th, and the 6th were incorporated many decades earlier. And so it's 2010 before the Second Amendment is held to be applicable to the states. Okay. I think there are some really important implications here. First, between 1939 and 2008, the court hears virtually no case, no case of any significance anyway, involving the regulation of firearms. When the court finally does hear two cases in pretty rapid succession in 2008 and 2010, its decisions were fundamentally different from the approach that it took in 1939 in Miller. And the modern cases, and this will be the most political thing that I will say tonight, the modern cases reveal the significant influence of the National Rifle Association. So I want to just say a few words about the NRA. It is, I think, meaningful to understanding that shift that takes place in jurisprudence to know that the NRA doesn't have an official lobbying arm until 1975. So up until 1975, well, they don't do anything involving kind of monitoring legislation until the 1940s. But between 1943 and 1975, the NRA would simply send kind of legislative updates to members, but the association itself was not engaging in any kind of concerted lobbying effort, either of Congress or at the courts. In 1975, they begin to take collective action as an interest group in terms of their advocacy activity. This is consistent with what we know about what happens in the 60s and the 70s. So when the court in the 60s starts declaring certain rights to exist, lots of litigants thought, aha, the courts will be more open to our grievances than Congress. And so we're going to start bringing all kinds of rights claims to the courts. At the same time that that's happening, many of these groups, recognizing that to get to the courts, you have to have experts on how judicial process works and how to write case briefs, and you need lawyers, they start ramping up kind of a legal and advocacy arm. So the 60s and 70s, generally, you have this explosion of interest group activity, and the NRA is embedded deeply within that. And beginning in 1975, it starts to mount concerted efforts at lobbying both Congress and at trying to make policy change through the judiciary. So this current sort of anti-gun control position that says there should be no restrictions, that was the framers' intent, that it's an unfettered individual right, actually only dates back about 40 years. Beginning in the late 1970s, a few years after their lobbying wing forms, the NRA starts to engage a concerted effort to shift the legal community's understanding of what the Second Amendment means. There's a really interesting Washington Post account that back in 2008 in preparation for Heller, that talks about this, and I'll just read you a couple of comments. So from the Post article, quoting, "For more than three decades, the NRA has sponsored legal seminars, funded legal research, and encouraged law review articles that advocate an individual's right to possess guns, according to the organization's reports. The result has been a profound shift in legal thinking on the Second Amendment. And the issue of individual gun possession rights, once almost entirely ignored, has moved into the center of constitutional debate and study. For proponents of stricter gun control, the NRA's encouragement of favorable legal scholarship has been a mark of its strategic patient advocacy. Quote, I think this is one of the most successful attempts to change the law and to change a legal paradigm in history, says Carl T. Bogus, a professor at Roger Williams University School of Law in Rhode Island. Quote, they were thinking strategically. I don't think the NRA funds scholarship out of academic interest. I think the NRA funds something because it has a political objective. The article goes on to comment or to refer to an analysis done by Robert Spitzer, a professor of political science at the State University of New York at Cortland, who wrote The Politics of Gun Control. He notes that from 1912 to 1959, only 11 journal articles were published on the subject, all of them endorsing the prevailing opinion that it affects citizens only in connection with citizen service in a government-organized and regulated militia. The first articles advocating an individual right appeared in the 1960s, and scholarship endorsing that view took off in the late 1970s. From 1980 to 1989, as NRA support began to be felt, 38 articles on the Second Amendment were published in academic journals, 21 of which advocated an individual right. In the following decades, so the 1990s, 87 articles appeared, and a clear majority, 58 to 29, took an individual rights position, Spitzer's analysis showed. So again, there was a very concerted effort over a period of several decades to shift the way lawyers and then judges ultimately thought about the Second Amendment. This is not enormous. It's a brilliant strategy, right? I mean, if you're at any lobbying organization, if you have any, if you're a political group of any kind, what a fantastic, I mean, you have to be willing to play the long game, right? But this is the strategy that could be very effective in terms of shifting people's perspectives. Okay, quickly. The court has agreed to hear this sometime in the next term, which will start in October, New York State Rifle and Pistol Association, Inc., there are several other people, via the City of New York and the New York City Police Department's Licensing Division. And the question in this case is whether New York City's ban on the transporting of a licensed, locked, and unloaded handgun to a home or shooting range outside city limits is consistent with the Second Amendment, the Commerce Clause, and the constitutional right to travel. We don't yet know when they'll hear it, probably sometime in the fall. This is the first major case on the Second Amendment that the court will take up post-McDonald. So it'll be almost 10 years since the last time they heard a case. Okay, so a couple of quick concluding thoughts. So here's some unpopular opinions, maybe. It's pretty clear that the framers really did intend to create an individual right to keep and bear arms, at least to me, because service of able-bodied men in a citizen's militia was legally required, and each man was also legally required to provide his own weapon and ammunition. So you cannot be expected to do that if you don't have an individual right to keep and bear arms. And I think Scalia is likely right in D.C. v. Heller that just because the primary purpose of the Second Amendment was to ensure that the people could defend themselves through the militia, that doesn't mean that's the only thing the Second Amendment protects. The Second Amendment is not written in that way, and therefore to conclude that it only protects militia service would also not be a reasonable reading. And I think he's right. Because I think for many of us, we say, well, but you know, automatic weapons wouldn't have been anticipated by the framers, so really should that be protected? But I think he's right that you can't base your interpretation of constitutional rights in that way. They didn't anticipate computers, yet we know that there are needs for internet privacy protections. They didn't anticipate any range of things. They didn't anticipate cell phones or digital fingerprints or things like that that can be used in crimes, and yet the court all the time has to figure out how to treat these modern kind of inventions in light of what the Constitution said. So I think he's right to sort of dismiss that argument that says, well, any weapon that didn't exist at the time of the framers wasn't included in that as well. But since I think we probably, regardless of politics, think it is bad when gun violence occurs, there are maybe some more hopeful conclusions that I can offer as well. Nothing about the Supreme Court's prior decisions should lead any of us to think that the Second Amendment is set in stone. Constitutions are amendable. The framers were very clear that the Constitution should be amendable. That's the entirety of Article 5, and we know that even the amendments have been amended from time to time. Right? So the 14th and 15th collectively are changed by the 19th Amendment, right? Because under the 14th and 15th, granting voting rights to former slaves, women were explicitly excluded from definitions of citizenship. By the way, little trivia, the first time the word male appears in the Constitution is in the 14th Amendment, and it appears there twice. But the 19th Amendment overturns those parts of it. The 21st, of course, prohibition overturns the 18th Amendment. And one reading of Scalia's majority opinion in Heller, in that last paragraph, is as an invitation for Congress and the states to have a serious conversation about whether the amendment itself ought to be amended in light of the problems of firearms violence. His point, I think, in making the argument he makes in that conclusion is the courts aren't empowered to nullify this amendment. But I also think that the point he's trying to make, and what struck me specifically was in the expansive language he uses to say that just because a weapon didn't exist then, it doesn't matter. He's expansive about that, right? He, in my view, is challenging Congress to come back and say, actually, there are limits, right? Because that expands, I mean, you read that, Scalia is not a, he's not a liberal in any sense of the word, right? He's not looking to provide more expansive readings of the Constitution, and yet he writes this really expansive statement, he's not dumb, that could suggest that pretty much any weapon could be covered by the Second Amendment. And so I think there's a bit of a challenge that he's issuing in Heller, which is to say there should be regulation, but it can't come from this court. And so that more hopeful approach is, if potentially there's a tipping point being reached around the issue of gun violence, there are things that can be done. And there are things that can be done that would both protect reasonable rights for gun ownership and for bearing arms, while also taking measures to protect public safety. So with that, I've talked way longer than I meant to. So hopefully you all are not going home like immediately at 7:30, but I'm happy to engage questions, comments, discussion. Talk about the justices, hung out at the court for a year, whatever is on your mind.
I'm just gonna grab the mic in case you want to be heard.